So what I thought I would do tonight in sort of addressing this topic of Mr. Polytope, also known as Donald Coxeter. He was nicknamed Mr. Polytope by a mathematician when he did a stint at Princeton in the 1930s because he was so obsessed with polytopes, which are shapes in any number of dimensions. So what I thought I would do was sort of string together a number of anecdotes from the book. So essentially it will be a few readings from the book with segues. So one of the very first stories that I ever heard about Donald Coxeter, apart from the fact that he was the man who saved geometry and that he was the greatest classical geometer of the 20th century, and indeed one of the first stories that he told me was that as a boy he loved his nanny more than his mother. And this is his nanny, Mae Henderson. It's a photo that Coxeter kept framed on his dresser in his bedroom. And during the First World War, he lived alone with Mae in the countryside just south of London, a safe distance from the bombings in the city. So Mae was not only Donald's nanny, she was also his closest playmate and his teacher until about the age of 10, when Mae left to get married and Donald was sent off to boarding school. Donald's mother, Lucy G., was an artist, a portrait painter, and this is a portrait of Coxeter, which she painted when he was about 2 years old. And his father was a hobby sculptor and a baritone singer, but he made his living as a manufacturer of surgical instruments. Lucy was very independent-minded as a mother, Coxeter remembered, and she guarded her creative space. She had only grudgingly agreed to grant her husband's wish for a child. And brilliant though Donald was, Lucy did not want more children. Coxeter recalled that this was a point of contention between his parents, and one factor that ultimately led to their divorce, which truly broke Donald's heart. Even as an old man, when I met him, he was very saddened by the fact that his family unit had fallen apart. Coxeter's father, Harold, went on to marry again. He married the young daughter of family friends. Her name was Katie, and she was half of Harold's age and only 4 years Donald's senior. As it turned out, she happened to be the object of Donald's first crush. So to do a little amateur psychology, Coxeter coped with these emotional traumas by escaping into worlds of his own creation. He invented a language called Amalabian, and he wrote a 100-page novella about the land where it was spoken, which was inhabited by fairies called Bania, all of whom enjoyed very happy unions. He also composed ambitious musical arrangements, such as incidental music for G.K. Chesterton's play Magic. Though when his mother took him to consult about his musical talents, she took him to the Irish composer C.V. Stanford. Stanford said, educate him first. So, luckily he had mathematics as a backup, and he displayed his talents as a prodigious mathematician, winning a grade school essay for his multi-volume treatise titled Dimensional Analogy. And this was really the beginning of his life's works on polytopes. With the help of a tutor, Coxeter studied for the entrance examinations for mathematics at Trinity College, Cambridge. He was an expert at polytopes, but this had the result that he was dismally behind in some of the basics. So while cramming for the exams, his tutor forbade him from his favorite pastime, thinking in the fourth dimension. His tutor made him promise no thinking in the fourth dimension except on Sundays. Coxeter, in the end, won an entrance scholarship for Trinity College and did his PhD there, followed by a fellowship. So he was at Trinity from 1926 to 36, roughly. This, of course, was the era when women were only beginning to appear in mathematics and science journals. And one of them, of course, was Mary Cartwright, later Dame Mary Cartwright. She was up and coming at the time, though she was 7 years Coxeter's senior. In 1930, Cartwright came to Cambridge on a fellowship to study with G.H. Hardy. And that's Dame Mary at the top left there. Now, women could not obtain degrees at Cambridge in Coxeter's day, not until 1947 officially, whereas the University of London admitted women to degree programs as of 1878. Originally, Cambridge was all male, and that monastic sensibility endured for quite a while. From the 19th century, women were allowed to study courses, sit examinations, and have the result recorded. This was treated by other institutions as a degree or a titular degree. The difference was that without a full degree, women were excluded from the governing of the university. so it was a denial of the vote rather than of qualification. Despite Mary Cartwright's intersection with Coxter chronologically at Cambridge, during my research I didn't uncover any substantive interactions between the two of them. But while at Cambridge, Coxter did find an intellectual soulmate in Alicia Boole Stott, a housewife geometer, as he once described her. In addition to one or two close male friends, Patrick Duvall and John Petrie, and the occasional dalliance with Paul Erdős, Aunt Alice, as Coxter affectionately nicknamed her, was his main intellectual sounding board, if not a formal collaborator. And Alicia Boole Stott is in the middle there. When Coxter's turn came up for a session at H.F. Baker's famous Saturday afternoon mathematical tea parties, he once invited his Aunt Alice to deliver a joint lecture. Stott was a polytope aficionado, 47 years Coxter's senior, and Coxter credited her with introducing the word polytope to the English language from German. She did this in the first publication of her work in the year 1900. Over the years, Coxter became Stott's loyal promoter, telling the story of her life at every opportunity. Stott was the middle of five daughters, born to George Boole, known for his algebra of logic, and Mary Everest. The highest mountain in the world was named in honor of Stott's uncle, the surveyor Sir George Everest. Her father died when she was 4 years old, and she spent her early years repressed and unhappy with her maternal grandmother and great uncle in Cork. When Alice was about 13, Coxter wrote in his book Regular Polytopes, the five girls were reunited with their mother in a poor, dark, dirty, and uncomfortable lodging in London. There was no possibility of education in the ordinary sense, but Mrs. Boole's friendship with James Hinton attracted to the house a continual stream of social crusaders and cranks. It was during those years that Hinton's son, Howard, brought a lot of small wooden cubes and set the youngest three girls the task of memorizing the arbitrary list of Latin words by which he named them and piling them into shapes. To Alice's sister Ethel, and possibly Lucy too, this was a meaningless bore, but it inspired Alice at the age of 18 to an extraordinarily intimate grasp of four-dimensional geometry. Howard Hinton exposed Alice to his mystical interpretation of higher dimensions as well, but she did not care to follow him along these occult lines of thinking, said Coxter, noting that she soon surpassed him in geometrical knowledge. Her methods remained purely synthetic for the simple reason that she had never learned analytical geometry. In the 1980s, Stott rediscovered the six polytopes in four dimensions, and then, using ruler and compass, cardboard and paint, she produced a complete set of models of their central sections. And this is a slide of one set that is currently at Cambridge University. She, after attending Baker's tea party, she donated a set to Cambridge. But during the intervening years, before Stott met Donald, she led a life of drudgery, he recalled, rearing her two children on a very small income. She returned to her geometric work when her husband, Walter Stott, happened upon the work of Peter Schulte at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands, who also was investigating the central sections of the very same four-dimensional polytopes. Schulte arranged for the publication of Stott's discoveries, and their partnership continued until his death in 1913, after which Alicia abandoned her polytopes again until she met Coxeter. Coxter's alliance with Aunt Alice, he said, was a source of great joy. He once said, the strength and simplicity of her character combined with the diversity of her interests to make her an inspiring friend. They conducted an ongoing conversation about polytopes by letter and with visits back and forth between her house, which was just outside Cambridge. And Aunt Alice once sent Coxter on his way after tea and polytopes with a present, two matching lamps with wooden truncated icosahedra for bases, which he carefully carried on the train back to Cambridge. The two kept up correspondence, and Alicia was particularly smitten with the kaleidoscopes that Coxter had custom made to investigate the symmetries of his polytopes. Coxter was particularly interested in symmetry, discrete symmetries, as opposed to infinite symmetries. And as I was sort of getting up to speed on his work, one of the anecdotes that was relayed to me was the difference between discrete and infinite symmetries was well encapsulated by an anecdote about the astrophysicist Fritz Zwicky, And he liked to call people that he found particularly detestable spherical bastards. And that was because whichever way he looked at these people, they were equally offensive. And so symmetries of the sphere are infinite. No matter which way you look at a sphere, it looks the same. Whereas Coxeter enjoyed discrete symmetries, the symmetries of his polytopes, which he likened to exquisitely cut jewels. And this is a slide of stills taken from a 1960s documentary, which was very generously funded from the National Science Foundation. They had a budget of $1 million to produce a number of geometry short films, as well as an accompanying series of textbooks, which never materialized. But they got very sophisticated mirrors cut and lit, and he spent years and years working on these documentaries. And this is the image of a dodecahedron generated within kaleidoscopes. It's a spherical dodecahedron. So Alice wrote in one letter to Coxeter, "I can't tell you how thrilled I am at the thought of seeing your magic mirrors. It seems to me too wonderful for words, and I'm longing for next week to come, how you will wake up the stuffy mathematicians on Saturdays." So Coxeter in the 1930s also did two stints at Princeton. He got two separate fellowships and spent 2 years there. And he said those amounted to the happiest times of his life. One year his friend Pat Duvall came, and this is a photo of them relaxing at Princeton. And Coxeter by then finally had more on his mind than math. He bought a car and took road trips often into New York, and often got speeding tickets along the way. He was known to be a rather horrendous driver. One time he and Duvall took in an AMS meeting, after which they went to see some burlesque. Coxeter had never had a girlfriend by the age of 23, but while in the States, he made a personal resolution to find a suitable woman to bring home to England and make his wife. He filed this progress report to his father in a letter. "I have met a really perfect girl a fortnight ago, her first and my second time at the square dancing class. Very graceful, with straight black hair, good features, and pale complexion, I thought, surely she cannot still be unmarried, as she looks at least 22. But her beautiful hands were ringless. The mere touch of those hands seemed unlike that of anyone else's. The next time, a week ago, I contrived to have her for my partner almost all the time, but it was impossible to talk. Afterward, I asked who she is, and was merely told that she is one-quarter squaw. At that, I was enormously thrilled and wove the most marvelous fantasies about her. I thought I would begin by inviting her to the faculty dance. And then today, I learned that her husband is an assistant lecturer in geology. So you see, fate has been very kind in every matter save the most important of all. I must relinquish all my lovely fantasies, which culminated in a triumphant return to England with my bride and the prospect of 1/8 Red Indian children. The shock was pretty bad, and I consider myself very unfortunate. Burwell, who was one of his new friends in the States, says that 99.99% of all American married women wear a ring. Would you say that if I am as keen as all that, her already being married ought not to mean nothing to me? I can only reply that her husband must be a better man than I, else she would not have accepted him. And I think they are happy. I am writing this in bed in the middle of the night. Being too bowled over to sleep, I get some comfort by relating this sorrowful story to you, my dearest friend. Now I will try to find solace in Felix Klein's lectures on the icosahedron." So resigned to leaving romantic matters in arrears, Coxeter had a very productive time of it at Princeton. He wrote to his father and reported that polytopes were considered an anathema in America. But nonetheless, he made leaps and bounds with his polytopes research that year. It was there at Princeton that he first invented or discovered his now famous Coxeter diagrams. He was so single-minded about his polytopes, as I mentioned, that Salman Lefschetz took to calling him Mr. Polytope. But this type of mathematics was very unfashionable in that day. Geometry, the very visual, hands-on approach, was fine for a recreational pursuit for idling away Sunday after mornings, but it certainly was not worth staking a career on. Coxeter noted in his diary that Lefschetz one day dismissed his work, his prized discovery of his Coxeter diagrams, by saying, "It's good to think of trivial things occasionally." These were heady times at Princeton, however, with the Institute for Advanced Study being in its first year and attracting the best mathematicians from all over Europe, many refugees from the onslaught of Hitler's rule. At the Institute, Coxeter connected with Hermann Weyl, who was doing related work. And a good friend of Weyl's, who often visited Princeton during those years, was Emmy Noether, another benchmark for the status of women in mathematics. And that's Noether there in the center with Einstein, Hermann Weyl, and Salman Lefschetz at the bottom. Emmy Noether and David Hilbert had fought a long battle to get her on faculty at Göttingen around about 1915. And during this time, while they were unsuccessful, Hilbert had allowed Noether to lecture by advertising her courses under his name. Again, however, there was no evidence of Noether's and Coxeter's paths crossed, even though Emmy Noether was known for her revolutionary work in symmetry, a subject very close to Coxeter's heart. Noether had made what has been touted one of the most remarkable contributions to human knowledge in a theorem pertaining to symmetry and derived from Einstein's insights. Known as Noether's theorem, it states that for every symmetry in the laws of physics, there must exist a conservation law. If there is symmetry, then something is conserved. Even though Coxeter and Noether weren't close, it was very interesting to read about Noether's presence at Princeton. An academic refugee in one of Hitler's early sweeps, since she was not only Jewish but also a woman, Noether had accepted an invitation to the all-women's Bryn Mawr College in Pennsylvania, arriving in 1934. But she also made weekly trips to lecture at the Institute for Advanced Study and to visit her friends Weyl and Einstein, who was also there by 1933. During my research, I came upon a very comprehensive oral history of Princeton mathematics in the 1930s, comprehensive though the interviewees were all men. So it was particularly interesting to read their observations of Noether. The interviews recorded her presence with sort of Noether sightings. The interviews were, for example, she could be spotted walking up from the train station, always wearing the same outfit, a shiny, shapeless jumper that only accentuated her proportions, being almost as big around as she was high. One day, a mathematician standing in the common room window of Fine Hall saw her approaching, and he asked, "How can you tell a penguin from Emmy Noether?" The answer, "A penguin doesn't carry a briefcase." Weyl gave a more flattering portrait of Noether, saying, "The graces did not preside at her cradle." Another anecdote told how, during seminars, Noether stood at the blackboard with a wet sponge in hand and looked rather like a washerwoman, ready to erase as she worked. She was intellectually too impatient to wait for the water to dry, so she wrote on the blackboard when it was wet. This brought two unfortunate results. Her chalkings initially were invisible, emerging only upon drying. And then, once the writing had finally dried, it was nearly impossible to erase. Her multitasking complicated matters further. She'd write something of import below while erasing with her wet sponge above, producing a trickle of water rolling ominously downward. She didn't know quite what to do to stop the drop of water that was threatening to destroy her work, so she blew on it to direct it off course. The only other mention of women in the oral history was of the faculty wives and the parties they threw, and occasionally there was mention of the librarian of the Institute, who was known as Bunny, though she had a reputation for running the library with an iron fist. As I mentioned, Coxeter was focused on his polytopes at Princeton and on finding a wife. Before he left to go back to Cambridge in 1936, he proposed to an American woman with whom he'd had a long time on-again, off-again dalliance. He wrote home upon first meeting her in saying, "Dorothy Henry really does give me a feeling of companionship, being interested in the right sort of things. She is vegetarian because she once saw the Chicago stockyards. She is religious without being sectarian. She actually seems to like me, which is such a new complication that I'm not quite sure which way to turn." But when Coxeter's father met Dorothy during a visit to America a year later, Harold concluded his son had made a mess of the relationship, as he recounted in a letter home to his wife. "Donald now has duly proposed to Dorothy after waiting and waiting too long, in my opinion. She is fond of him and has enjoyed him as a friend, but she is very sensible and understanding and realizes that he is not really in love with anybody but himself, nor likely to be. She sees his lack of development clearly enough, and as she says to me, she does not want to mother him as well as children. I don't think there was much likelihood of her marrying him, unless by some miracle he should want her so much that he changes and becomes less self-centered. I must say he has been very charming and considerate during the whole time we've been together. Quite a test, I think. But he is not very considerate, really, of anyone else, and very greedy and anxious to have the best possible, always. As Harold predicted, Dorothy rejected Coxter's proposal. Back in Cambridge, Coxter met Rene Brower a few months later, in March 1936. In May, he proposed to her in a Cambridge cemetery. He recorded in his diary, "Rene to supper," asked her, and she did not say no. They were married shortly after the death of Donald's father the following August, and days later they were sailing for Canada for his position at U of T. There were no mathematics professorships open in England, or very few. He had lost out on the one spot, the Lowndean chair in astronomy and geometry, which went to William Hodge. And the same year, in 1936, Mary Cartwright became the director of studies in mathematics at the all-women's Girton College. Settled in Toronto, Coxter and Rene, the mathematician and the housewife, established a nice economy of existence. Rene prepared their separate diets. Coxter was a vegetarian, and Rene had made a failed attempt to follow suit. Mealtime was scheduled like clockwork at 8, 12, and 6, the table set, the radio tuned to the news. Coxter always dressed for breakfast, even on weekends and holidays, and always wore a tie. Rene insisted, finding his neck unattractive. All the workings of the household were similarly calibrated to facilitate Coxter's profession. The dynamic was etched in the mind of one of his early students, John Coleman, now a professor emeritus at Queen's. He needed to consult with Coxter outside office hours and telephoned his professor at home to make plans to drop by. Rene greeted Coleman when he knocked, barked in this beautiful Dutch, thick Dutch accent, "What do you want?" She was like a bulldog at the door, remembered John Coleman. Rene treated her husband as a precious object, protecting his time and his space, optimizing the parameters of his life for a career of mathematical productivity. Coxter once told me, "I was not able to love Rene as fully and completely as one should his wife." He devoted most of his time and energy to his geometry. Rene humored herself by saying that at least her husband would not stray. Math was his mistress. One weekend, he mischievously procured an invitation for his wife and their two children to visit a colleague's cottage without him, so he could stay home and be alone to work on his book, Regular Polytopes. He saw nobody all weekend, worked hard to get a chapter done, but his finagling brought regret, leaving me alone and miserable, he noted in his diary. And it plummeted Rene into misery. "Rene thinks I am trying to drive her crazy," he wrote. "I must take more responsibility for the children." Coxter made token efforts to help with the parenting. He recorded in his diary that he sat writing the final copy of Regular Polytopes in the bedroom of his daughter, then age 3, who had the measles. Coxter was a mathematical pioneer and progressive in terms of his worldview and his views about politics, but he was a stern and chilly conservative as far as child rearing was concerned. He seemed to subscribe to a view advocated by Harold H. Punk at Auburn University in Alabama. "Intellectually competent persons should breed," Punk argued, "but not be bothered with the charges of child-rearing in order that they use their time and energy for other purposes." The flaws in that equation, as far as women are concerned, are fairly obvious. Punk's theories came to my attention because in 1957, Coxter reflected on his creative process in a survey sent to him by Punk, a professor of education. On the topic of creativity, Coxter observed, "It seems to emerge from the subconscious. Fresh air, exercise, and restful sleep are better than any artificial stimulants." His best times of the day were very early in the morning. His moments of contemplation, he said, left him never lonely or afraid, but surely thrilled. He relied on mental images in fostering ideas, and said imagination should be allowed unlimited scope. And he said his stream of ideas came to him, not increasingly, but "I have no fear of running dry, because the supply of unfinished projects would suffice to occupy me for many years to come, even if no completely new ideas appear from now on." Considering his work ethic, Coxter and Rene socialized and entertained a surprising amount. Though Rene always wished her husband wasn't so awkward and she was plagued by eternal discontent over the invitations she failed to receive. When she once went in for a checkup at the doctor's office, Coxter noted, "Dr. Owen found Reen physically healthy, prescribed a holiday, a maid, a hobby, and a full life. She would have preferred him to find a curable disease." Distracted as he was with his work, Coxter took only a passing interest in household matters, almost a spectator's interest. Reading his diaries, it was amusing to see how meticulously he recorded the difficulties Reen had in retaining a decent maid. He really seemed to quite relish the ordeal, and here's a sampling of his observations. "Miss Dixon said she couldn't bear vegetarian cooking, wouldn't come anymore. Day 4. Engaged new maid, Ethel, worked well. Ethel said she couldn't come anymore. Interviewed Mrs. Peacock. Mrs. Peacock failed to come. Maid Violet dismissed. We caught Viola with her young man. Gave her notice. Verna failed to show up. No more of her. Irene Dupuis came and worked well. Irene is irritating. Goes to the washroom too often at night. Irene didn't turn up. Joan drove R to the slums in search of a maid. No use. Mrs. Foster works well. Mrs. Foster can't come anymore. Not well. Maid Nora Keem failed to come. Fired Nora. We engaged May. May works well but eats a lot secretly. May stayed out till midnight. We were furious. May was abducted by her friends, who backed their car into the Browns' neighboring driveway and took her luggage through the window. Reen rang Mrs. Jeffrey, who took steps to try to locate her. No church, having no maid. Detectives on May's trail. I called on Mrs. Parsons to assure her we did all we could to make May happy. Mrs. Parsons admitted all her girls are morons." Coxer had not dissimilar bad luck dealing with his daughter Susan and her boyfriends. In her rebellious stage, Susan dated older men, whom her parents tried their darndest to do away with. One they accused of burglarizing their house repeatedly. Another boyfriend Coxter dispensed with after he caught the young man in a compromising position with Susan in the wee hours of the morning on the living room floor after a date. Coxter accused the fellow of taking advantage of his daughter, or was convinced to do so by Reen, and had the Dean of the University of Toronto Faculty of Medicine expel him from medical school. The fellow transferred to the University of Ottawa. And in a very odd turn of events, shortly after I met Coxter and was frequently at his house doing interviews, it was roughly 40 years later, and having forgiven Coxter, presumably, this man had the courage to come courting Susan again. She had recently been widowed by her husband, Alf, who was 11 years her elder. Coxter by then was a widower himself. This time, he decided he liked the fellow and issued him a written apology. Susan, nonetheless, declined the overtures of her suitor. On that note, I'll return to Coxter's professional relations with women. Coxter in total supervised 17 PhD students, only one a woman, Asya Ivic Weiss, now at York University. And that's Asya there with Cy Schuster to her left and Willie Moser, who's seated. When I was researching the book, I interviewed Asya, and one anecdote stood out in her mind as encapsulating Coxter's cognizance, or lack thereof, his obliviousness of the details of a woman's life. When Asya was pregnant with her first child, she was still completing her PhD, and Coxter's inexperience with female students became patently clear. He never once acknowledged her pregnancy. And when Asya called him to say that she had gone into labor and that she wouldn't be able to keep their weekly meeting to discuss her work, Coxter said, "Not to worry, I'll send some papers over to the hospital so that you can pass the time while you're waiting." And he said he'd see her the following week. At that point, Asya recalled that Reen was screaming at him in the background, telling him not to be so stupid, and Coxter corrected his mistake with an apology. I further investigated Coxter's relations with female colleagues by conducting a bit of an informal survey, speaking with Marjorie Senechel at Smith College and Doris Schatzmeier at Moravian College. Doris recalled that Coxter was well known to be a bit, and I quote, "clueless about the details of a woman's life." And Marjorie noted more broadly that Coxter perhaps fell into the general class of men who are perfectly happy to treat women colleagues as full professionals, just like their male colleagues, while at the same time expecting, even demanding, that their own wives fulfill traditional roles. In other words, they think of women colleagues as honorary males, so their attitudes towards women in their own fields and women in general may be very different. All in all, however, the consensus on Donald Coxter was that he judged mathematicians on their mathematics, not their gender. He was interested in ideas wherever they came from. And that said, to conclude, I think Coxter's sexual politics were in some ways ahead of his time, and on occasion and when necessary, evolved with the times. Thank you very much.